we've done a lot of, my colleagues and I, we've done a lot of group studies, and we've done, you know, the randomized controlled trial, et cetera. But I want to share with you, and this is actually going to be published in our journal, the 000000 is because it hasn't been assigned a page number. It's published September, October in the American Journal of Occupational Therapy for 2008. And what we were able to do, which I was, it's a case study, but it's a young man, and it basically not only describes what the sensory and motor issues feel like to him, but then it also talks about some of the impact of interventions. And I'll tell you a little bit about this young man. I taught a graduate course on sensory processing this summer up at NYU, and this is someone who's incredibly anxious, lots of anxiety, and was able to come to New York City, which he never has been to my classroom, which he has never been to present in front of 20 people. And I asked him how he was able to do all this, and he said, "I need people to know and understand this." So again, you know, and I think from so many perspectives, we know the power of motivation. Okay. So what is motivating this individual? And I think what motivated him is really sharing his perspective. And I'll tell you a little bit about this individual. He is someone that IQ 50, I guess testing, IQ 50 testing, types independently, never used facilitated communication, started typing independently at age 14. Okay, one of those kids that you hear about that all of a sudden could access language and typing, and then could also remember everything since the age of 2 and have an opinion about it. And I'll tell you, when he first started typing, there were so many expletives that he typed, it was really, he was mad. So that was 5 years ago when he first started typing. He's now 19. And I was able to give him a guest speaker honorarium of $300 when he came to my class, okay, which was beside the point. He really liked that. But I think the words that I put up on here, and it is in a journal article, and you can go get the journal article, but for me, he's someone that can clearly articulate, clearly and very powerfully articulate. He's nonverbal, types independently, has a pathfinder, can clearly articulate what it's like for him. Now, let's throw him out because he's an N of one, right? Or let's listen and see what he tells us. And I'll tell you, after interviewing 80, he's an N of 80. Okay, he just happens to really, really be someone that I have grown close to, and I'll give you a pseudonym for him. Let's call him Tom. But you know, Tuesdays with Maury, I have my Fridays with Tom. And I have used the opportunity. We're now working on, all right, Tom, you've told me everything about how it feels. What do you want? What are your goals? What do you want to be able to do? Let's get you there. And we did a whole transitional map, person-centered planning with him, et cetera. Because we can learn a lot from individuals. But it's like, you have your life. What do you want? What do you see your life doing? And part of what he sees himself doing is presenting and teaching people about autism and the sensory and motor issues. So I share with you his words in, with his permission, and from this article. From a sensory modulation perspective, we spent the time talking about sensory modulation, and you can read his words. He's the one that talks about his body feeling like cement. I can't move how I want. No muscles work. They are really cement. He talked about, and I know we have this, and I'm going to address your questions, this young man here. We have this relationship of, and you even have books, is it sensory or is it behavior? Okay, sensory or is it behavior? And what you always see is behavior. That's the observational thing that you see is behavior. Okay, but what is contributing to that behavior? And I think we've got to kind of, and this is, again, Christy's soapbox, I'm stepping up on it. We've got to break down these silos of behaviorists and floor time people and people that say sensory processing and people that say this, this, this. These kids need all of us. And they need all of us doing it well, not bad. Okay? But there's got to be room for that dialogue and room for really coming to an understanding and valuing and respecting each other's position. And that's where it starts. If I don't value your position, I'm an OT. Okay? I used to think everything was sensory. Everything's sensory. We're so wonderful. We have the answer. We can solve the problem. Okay? That was me 15 years ago. Maybe 10 years ago. Okay? That's not what I believe anymore. I'd be foolish if I believed that, knowing what I know. No, this isn't here. This, but that's why I gave you the reference, because if you want the reference, you can have all these quotes and more. You know, if you look up, you got to wait a little bit because it doesn't come out till September. Okay. But I just took a couple of the quotes from this article. But, you know, I think that if we, so much of the OT identity is tied to the sensory processing piece, you know, and sensory integration and the controversy, and so much of the behavioral perspective is, it's not valid, it's not reliable, it hasn't been well studied. It's not evidence-based practice. Okay. I will ask you to allow us to do good research and then see if we're dismissed or not. Because we, unlike a lot of the psychologists in the room, we were clinicians. We didn't go to do research and postdocs and have a research and then do really good research design. None of us learned it. We were a master's degree, terminal degree. You got your master's degree. That was the highest degree we got in our fields 10, 15 years ago. We're new to the PhD, postdoc. We're just getting funded. So afford or not, but I think some really good research is coming out. We're doing randomized controlled trials. We're getting trained and we're including things like the ADOS and the ADIR as inclusion criteria. We're having fidelity measures that are recent. We're doing a manualized protocol that still isn't published. Okay. So I think that we've got to respect the differences and understand the differences. Because bottom line, it's not about you or I. It's about that 4-year-old, the 8-year-old, the 12-year-old, the 18-year-old, the 24-year-old. Okay. So if what you can do helps them, great. If what I can do helps them, wonderful. Okay. Did I address it? Well, I don't think necessarily the inclusion or exclusion of the DSM is going to... That's going to be such a long time coming, number one. But I think what's going to be more impactful of that is, are there good, solid research studies to either refute or support? That's what's going to impact more than it being in the manual, because that's not going to happen for... New manual's 2012. If it's pending further study, then the next one that comes out, which is 2020, that'd be the decision if it's in there or not. I think what's going to be more important is the good research studies. And let me say something about, like, you're not an OT and you're doing some sensory strategies. Thank God. Because that means that if that is helpful to that child and it helps with their engagement and attention and focus, and you're integrating it in your classroom and you're using them, they're going to get it way more than the half hour a week I can give because I got 800 kids on my caseload. So I'm okay with that. That's the issue. And again, that speaks to fidelity. And we've got to do a better job of saying what it is and what it's not. I'm going to talk about YouTube later. You go onto YouTube and type in brushing programs. There's your homework. You get a lot of hits and you get a lot of weird stuff, okay? Some legit, some not. I think the onus is upon, in this case, OTs, because these are a lot of the strategies we use, to really teach what we're doing and why, and then tie it to relevant outcomes. Okay? Gone are the days where I take the kid down to my OT room and do my voodoo magic and take him back and no one knows why I'm doing what he's doing, but he's happy. Okay? We've got to do scientifically driven practice, which implies that we're educating people about why we're doing what we're doing, what outcomes to suggest. And it can't be, well, I know it works, but I don't know why, so try it. Or auditory integration training. Some of you might have done auditory integration training. And I'm not going to give an opinion one way or another about that, but if I go for auditory integration training or Tomatis, which is what, around 15 grand, well, I'm not sure what it's going to change, but keep a log and we'll see. We've got to be smarter. We've got to really look at tying in those strategies with outcomes and then measuring them systematically. Okay. All right, so back to my friend Tom. And this is a 14-year-old nonverbal with an IQ of 50. Let's not forget that, because we've tested him very accurately. How did he know a word like accosting? I don't know. Must have been Barney. The ears work. He's telling you, I hear it the same way you hear it. The ears work, but the sounds are mixed up with all the sounds around the room. Sounds are accosting me. What does accosting mean? Attacking. It doesn't mean, oh, they hurt a little bit. It means it's this overwhelming press. They're coming in. I can't filter them out and stop them. Okay, which is interesting. Taste is okay. It's extreme. Smell is all inside the room, and that's overwhelming to my head and brain. That's what he kind of told us about that sensory processing. We had another young man that told us that, talked about sensory anguish. And I brought him this is when I was at Temple. We brought him in. We were interviewing him with my graduate students. And we have a fan, an overhead fan. You know, rooms that have those overhead fans. Every university has them. You go in and there's these overhead fans running. And he came into the room and he was clearly agitated. He's 25. And he types independently as well. And he sat there and he typed. He said, "It's the fan." And I said, "Well, we can go to another room." And he was very, didn't want to rock the boat. We had five people there. He said, "No, I'll try it." So we started talking and asking questions. And he just said, "Can I get up and move underneath the fan?" And I said, "Sure." And he got backed up. And the overhead fan was kind of back here. And he was back there. And we moved back there. It was kind of becoming a comedy of errors at this point. And he started rocking. And he typed, he said, he goes, "I'm stuck. I have to rock to the sound of the fan." And if you watched his rocking, it was definitely to the rhythm of this. And I said, "All right, we can move to another room. It's okay." And he finally said, "Okay." We moved to another room, didn't have this overhead fan. And he sat down immediately and he typed, "What do you want to know?" Okay. Clearly, this environmental thing in there was really derailing him. No different than that smell of the Ralph Lauren polo. And again, optimal arousal suggests I can't be overstimulated or understimulated if I'm going to learn. Now, understimulated, let's think about understimulated. If I'm understimulating your sensory systems, okay, and I'm your professor, and I know none of you had any professors like this, but let's say I'm your professor. And we talk and we open our book up to page 16. Everybody on page 16. I'm going to read from the text. Please follow along. What happens to your arousal level? Okay. So understimulation, overstimulation from the sensory modulation perspective can impact learning. I just understimulated you from a sensory perspective. Anyone have a professor like that? And what did you say to yourself? "When I go home, I'm going to have to teach myself this. I got nothing." Okay? And you taught yourself because your arousal level was so low. Or arousal level. How many of you have read a book, textbook, let's go back to college, and you find yourself reading the same line again? And again and again? And you go, wait, you're kind of losing your visual vigilance, right? You go, "Didn't I just read this? What's happening?" Your arousal level is too low. I tell my students then, I say, if that happens, you push yourself away from the book because you will get nothing more out of it. You will. If that happens to any of you, you're reading the same, stop. Stop, do something else. No different than what we talk about with the kids that we serve. Their arousal level, not good. Take a movement break, do something. Okay, because they're not going to be there. They're not going to be ready and attentive to learn. Yes.
I have a question that I just can't seem to figure out who to ask, but my son seems to be over-emotionally stimulated by a lot of things. Like, he's five and he'll see somebody else like crying, like maybe his mom's head, and he's about to cry too. There's SpongeBob's falling out of the pineapple, and he's, ah! I mean, my son's falling out of the pineapple too. And it's just getting to a point where I'm sifting through watching things before him, seeing if I even want to let him watch it.
Well, that's another issue. I don't necessarily think that's a sensory issue. It might be that he's just very connecting emotionally with these characters, and then in a way that is more about emotional regulation and really regulating his emotion. Talk to me afterwards, and I'll give you some suggestions. Okay. All right. Sensory input. You know what? I just realized I'm not repeating any questions. Good for me. Okay. Thank you for giving me that direct instruction that I did not follow. Concept of sensory diet. We've heard of sensory diets. Sensory diets are often used with kids that are on the spectrum or have sensory issues. And I think with sensory diets, if you're going to use them, use them. If you're going to do a half hour a week, why bother? You know, and I think that if they're helpful, you'll know. And I would encourage you to take data about you started this strategy. You decided that my colleague Beth Pfeiffer, she did a study with the sit discs, those little cushions, the sit cushions that kids can sit on that kind of give them a little bit more input. She did a study where she did a typically developing second graders, where she randomly assigned kids to the sit disc condition or the not sit disc condition. And she did find that it increased attention. Increased attention and time on task, okay, typically developing kids. So that's an evidence-based strategy. You say, okay, there's some evidence for that. Let me try it. Let me have this little sit disc be part of my child's sensory diet or this student's sensory diet. If you're going to do something like that, okay, then do it on a regular basis. You can look at that study and see how often it was done to get kind of a parameter of, well, how often did they sit on it? How often did they not? Don't reinvent the wheel. If there's some studies out there, do that. I'll tell you, there's no good studies on brushing, so you're not going to get any information on that. There's pressure vests. The studies aren't good, so you're not going to get any information on that. Okay, they're not very well designed. So that's a good design study, the sit disc. Okay, that does. And if you want the reference, email me. But that's a good design study. So you say, okay, let me see how they did it. Actually read the middle part of that article. Read the method, which would tell you how they did it and at what time and da da da. And then try it as part of that sensory diet. Okay? And then take data to see if it actually increased the same things that increased in this article, for example. It's a nice, easy to do data collection. Okay. But if you're going to do the sensory diet, do it on a regular basis. Now, I will say I've seen some crash diets, if you will, where, and again, how should I say this without being offensive? I've had one kid that came to me that was the Ripley's Believe It or Not kid that really needed intensive brushing. We did it for a weekend, and it dramatically altered. We did a crash diet. He was sleeping 10 minutes at a time, no more than 10 minutes at a time, ever. He was over-aroused all the time. Okay. We did a crash diet of brushing, and he slept for 8 hours. I didn't know that would happen. Mom didn't know what happened. I said, I don't know what's going to happen. I was my own worst enemy. I don't know what's going to happen, but they were getting ready to put a G-tube in this kid because he wasn't eating and he wasn't sleeping. And he had a lot of these sensitivities, like here. This is a Ripley's Believe It or Not case, but try it. One kid, crash diet. Okay. He still had a lot of other issues, but that kid was sleeping. Do I know the mechanism? No. Okay. So be mindful of the evidence and what evidence is out there, but blanket prescriptions for brushing. We brush everybody now, don't we? Everybody has brushing as part of their sensory diet. For the individual whose quote I gave you, brushing really helps. He talks about his body feeling like cement. And just like you wake up your arm in the middle of the night, that's what he uses it for, and it's a strategy that helps him. Okay? But blanket kind of brushing as part of every sensory diet, not good. Because then you'll end up, like I said earlier, chasing that kid around. Time to do brushing. Okay? So be mindful of this idea of, okay, crash. You got to do it every 2 hours. Here's what we if you're going to do that, that's a dramatic intervention. You should see something dramatic happen. It's like medication. It's like anything. If you're doing a dramatic intervention that's very time intensive, you should see some dramatic results. Okay. But it does benefit some. But this idea of doing it regular versus a crash. If you have the OT brushing once a week for a half hour, the kid's on a starvation diet. Okay, that's what your diet is. So, you know, that's where that role release happens when people do it. Okay, provide the child with predictability and control, choice. We bring kids in, adults are very different. Working with adults is very different. We bring in adults, for example, and we just let them try a lot of different things, and they tell us what works. You would be surprised how often the treadmill works. Okay, treadmill, good. Because it not only gives you kind of that weight bearing, but it also gives you that regular rhythm. And for a lot of these individuals that have these motor issues, for some of the adults with autism, that's the first time they felt like their body was in a rhythm, which is interesting. You know, if you watch gait patterns and some of the research on gait patterns, where I really felt like I was in a rhythm. If you're talking about sensory input, you're talking about touch, movement, and proprioception. And we're going to talk about proprioception. But touch, movement, we know what touch is, we know what movement is. Proprioception, okay? How many of you know what proprioception is? OTs are wonderful at describing proprioception so that no one can understand it. We are so good at that. We say, oh, well, you know what? He needs proprioceptive input in order to feel where his body is in space. How's that? Is that what we say? Yeah, we say that. Okay. What does that mean? Anyone? Proprioceptive input. Everybody stand up. If you have back problems or hip problems, or I'm going to ask you to pound a little bit, so if you do have problems, opt out, because I don't want you saying, that little activity you had us do really hurt me. Okay. Just take your right leg. Everyone feel your right leg. Be one with your right leg, okay, very zen. I just want you to stamp your right leg 10 times on the floor. That's your right leg doing now. Tingling? You feel it? Now, for those of you where your right leg isn't tingling, you might need more, but you don't have to do more, okay? Just go home and do more. But you probably are much more aware of your right leg, right? It's tingling a little bit. Now you probably want to do your left leg to even it out. Maybe go ahead if you need to even it out. Okay. All right, sit down. You have proprioceptors in every joint of your body. Okay, they're in your muscles, your joints, your tendons. And what proprioceptors do is they give you how I just made you more aware of your right leg. I just stimulated the proprioceptors in your hip, your knee, your ankle. That's what that tingling was. Ooh, I'm aware of that joint. So that proprioceptive input, when we say, well, he needs proprioceptive input so he can get a better awareness of where he is in space, you basically just did it. Okay, that's proprioception. That's why a lot of the kids will look for proprioception, because they want to know where their body is in space. They'll crash, they'll bump, they'll bang, they'll want you to push their head. They'll push their head into things. The most proprioceptors you have are right at the neck. That's why a lot of this is done. Okay, and they'll go and they'll lean in. They're looking for that proprioceptive input. And you get it when you jump, when you stomp, when you pound. That was fun, wasn't it? Okay, so proprioception, if you don't know that word, hopefully it now has a little bit more meaning. Okay, we use proprioception. Proprioception is also used to calm us. I worked in a NICU for several years, a neonatal intensive care unit, and nurses, any nurses here? Former nurses, any nurses? Okay. The nurses so prided themselves on the way they folded those blankets around the baby. And remember how you couldn't do it as a new mom, and you looked at these tight little bundles, and you could pick them up, and they didn't move because that blanket was folded? That nice proprioceptive input, isn't it? It's very calming. You wrap up a baby, you hold a baby tight, you rock. Okay. We use proprioceptive input to feel our bodies, and we use proprioceptive input to calm our bodies. Deep massages. Who likes deep massages? And you almost fall asleep? Okay. That's, again, that proprioceptive input. A lot of the kids and people that we serve, though, just are looking at it for a variety of ways that usually don't work and usually are inappropriate. Mm-hmm. That's appropriate. Like, they'll take your hand up when you squeeze here, here, here. Okay, that's that proprioceptive input. If that's what they're doing, you think about that sensory diet and say, how can I build that in all day in ways that are maybe more long-term, because I like to think long-term, adolescents and adults, more appropriate. I had a young man that loved hugging his parents from behind really, really hard. Okay, and it was from behind. Mom and Dad had to turn around, and then he would just grab him and squeeze him, which was really cute at 5, but at 13, you know, that's tough. But he was, what was he seeking out? He was seeking out that intensive input. We got him going to the gym and lifting weights. Okay, and it was hard at first, but he stuck with it, and he would lift these weights, and he was in an environment that was in the community with other peers. He'd bring a play date. Their play date would be to go to the gym at age 14. And lift weights, you know, and you can kind of shift that perspective. It's very different than brushing 2 hours a day with joint compression. I can't do that with friends and, you know, get the input. Okay, you brush me, now I'll brush you. And I'm not dissing brushing, but let's think about if that's the kind of input I need, this squeezing, how else can I get it? And where else can I get it? And resistive swimming, karate, weightlifting, you know, what are some things that give me that pounding, that banging, that crashing that I can do in a way that meets those needs? The hand flapping serves a whole bunch of purposes. The hand flapping, Well, I'm going to tell you about the hand flapping with sensory input. You can do, hold on, can you finish your question? He said, what about the hand flapping? There, I just repeated a question. He said, what about the hand flapping? The hand flapping, we had a lot of individuals describe it for a variety of reasons. Okay, some, it's just something to do when I'm bored. Others, I do it if I'm overstimulated and I'm trying to calm myself. So this, if I'm trying to calm myself and stay, might serve a function. You may be able to replace it with another behavior that helps me calm myself in another way that might be based in proprioception. Okay, but I'll tell you, I know a lot of kids that have been in intensive behavioral intervention programs and OT and speech therapy and gotten every service known to man. Okay, and part of it was to stop a lot of these behaviors. And a lot of these kids, they still come out. You know, you still stiffen when you're excited, but you can reduce them. But to say completely eliminate them, I think is a tough charge. I think it's a tough charge for some of those body-based things. Okay. And I think that we want them to go away. We want them to go away because we know the social ramifications of them. So we need to think about it in terms of replacement. The argument, he said, the argument is, when he's in school, should he be allowed to do them or not? I think that there are a couple things that I've learned. There's a need there. So I've got to think about what is that need and how can I meet it? Because to say, you're not allowed to do them in school and not recognize the need is a road that could ultimately lead to failure. So I can eliminate or decrease, but if I recognize the need, I might replace it with some things that are different. Or if you give me a reason, And I'll give you an example. I worked with an adolescent with Asperger's, and he loved to do this. I can't even do it. It hurts my neck. But he loved to do this and kind of do, again, do this head jerky head movement that gave him a lot of input. And I was interviewing him, and he was 14. Yeah, 14. And he said, but I don't do that in school. He said, I do it in my room. I said, well, why don't you do it in school? What? And his mom was happened to be an OT, actually. And he said, well, my mom told me that if I do it in school, I won't get a date. Again, from a behavioral perspective, it was a compelling enough reason. Now, he still did it, and it still felt good, but he learned kind of fair compromise. Fair compromise. This young man had a question. What's your question?
Is that why I love to swim at the bottom of the swimming pool at the YMCA?
He said, is that why, what, proprioceptive, getting that banging and deep pressure? He said, is that why I love to swim to the bottom of the pool at the YMCA? It could be. Could be. It could also be because you really like setting a goal and getting it. Okay. All right. So it's how you think, not what you use. If you're thinking, again, if I give you the cookbook that says do A, B, C with touch, movement, and proprioception, that may not work for that child that you're working with. But if you think, let me consider the idea of touch, movement, and proprioception as a way to either increase or decrease this over-responsive or under-responsive system, I'm going to be thinking differently. Going to be thinking differently, yes.
Going back to your idea we were just talking about, shaking the hand, or rocking back and forth, to reduce it, because I myself believe it can't be eliminated. What would you do?
Well, there's a bunch of different strategies that you can use, whether it's a behaviorally based strategy or looking at replacement behaviors or from a sensory perspective. If I see someone doing a behavior that would suggest they're seeking out movement, touch, or proprioception, and if that behavior is such that those are the things they're seeking out, I want to try to give them one of those things in a way that's more appropriate throughout their school day. That could be a variety of things. That could be a movement break where I grab the wagon filled with all the library books and I go all the way around the school. I don't know what happened. Yeah, I have a hand up, see where I am. I don't usually follow this. Okay, all right. Okay, so, you know, there's not saying, do this and then flapping will stop, okay? But I think if you think, is it trying to get input? You know, is it trying to make me aware of where I am in space? Is it giving me movement? Is it giving me the feeling of moving if I do this, which is kind of, it's called an optokinetic nystagmus. If I kind of can trigger that little feeling of movement, if I look at a fan or wave my hand, is it giving me something like that? And if it's giving me something like that, well, then why don't you try replacing it with something that would give that input, but in a more appropriate way first? Because it's not going to be eliminated. It's not going to be eliminated. Okay. And I gotta be honest with you. The adults we interviewed, they were pretty mad about this idea. That we had one guy say, "You chew gum, I hum a lot, get over it." You know? Because if it doesn't go away, okay. Now, the ramifications are, there are some social ramifications here that we can't dismiss with a ha ha ha, it's okay. Because socially, that's the thing that's going to maybe prevent individuals from interacting with me, coming up to me. I might scare people away. But I'll tell you, there's many reasons why these individuals engage in that type of behavior. And I think it behooves us to figure that out, to really figure that out. And look at, it might be, now maybe it's the only coping strategy I have. Maybe I am so overstimulated, and this is how I cope. Okay. So if that's the only coping strategy I have, and you take that away, then this might be how I cope. Okay. So I think we need to be a little bit better detectives with that versus just kind of a yes, no, eliminate, not eliminate. There are some social ramifications there, though. So especially with typically developing peers. Oh yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, and from a central nervous, from a exactly. If I don't have language to express it too, that's going to impact. But I know my typically developing. He's now 13. When he was 1 and 2, anything that moved, especially lawnmowers, produced this response. I'm so excited, and I can't tell you how excited I am. Okay. Now, that dampened with age, and a lot of those flapping responses you see and things like that do dampen with age. Okay. And he doesn't do this when he sees a lawnmower. Now it's just baseball. If the Phillies are winning, we get this. But I think we've got to be very mindful of looking at what's the need, and then also respecting the fact that that behavior really is one that everyone gets on board and says it's got to stop. Okay. So if it's got to stop, what are you going to replace it with? What are you going to replace it with? Oh, optokinetic nystagmus, that's the million-dollar word. OPTOKINETIC. Kinetic nystagmus. If I turn you around in a circle and you get dizzy, the dizziness that you're feeling, your eyes are going back and forth.
Oh, I thought maybe that was
a response to... Well, hold that thought. So if I spin you around and I stop you, your eyes are going back and forth like this. That's why the room feels like it's swimming. Because if I watch your eyes, they're going like this. That's nystagmus. Optokinetic nystagmus is the ability to kind of trigger that response by looking at something without moving.
Thank you.
All right. Okay. Speaking of not looking at something, okay. The next slide, use of touch, movement, and proprioception to influence arousal. You have two types. You have things that are going to inhibit and things that are going to facilitate. And this can be anything with touch, movement, proprioception. If I want to calm that over-responsive system, if I want to inhibit it, I do things that are rhythmical. I do things that are sustained, slow, expected. If I kept talking to you like this and I said, okay, everybody, let's all start rocking, we'd be asleep in about 15 minutes. Some of us wouldn't, but I would. Okay, facilitation, if I want, and this is with anything. This is any movement, any touch, any proprioception. That's the concept. Is it rhythmical? Is it sustained, slow, expected? How many of you rock that baby when they were young to the point where you fell asleep? Okay, you are giving yourself some beautiful inhibitory input while the baby may have been still awake. Okay. And you're just looking at that baby going, well, I'm asleep, why aren't you asleep? Versus that facilitation, it's that one. Talk amongst yourselves. Thank you. Okay, so rhythmical, sustained, slow, expected, versus arrhythmic, uneven, rapid, unexpected. A lot of the kids that are sensory seekers are looking for that second column. They want fast, change in direction, arrhythmic. And then you've got to consider the type of input, location, direction, intensity, frequency, position. So anything. You put up any piece of equipment, any toy, and there can be inhibitory properties to it and facilitatory properties to it. You put up a ball, a big ball, you can do inhibitory things with it, and you can do facilitatory things with it. You put up that brush, you can do inhibitory things with it, you can do facilitatory things with it. What I'm asking you to do is think about why you're doing what you're doing with some of these things. And are you getting it? If you're going to do something that's inhibitory, and you're not getting a kid that's going from up here down to here, it's not working. It's not working. I just gave you some examples of calming stimuli. Again, inhibitory. And with proprioception, some of the, you think of, well, isn't that excitatory? And I put jumping and running. If you run for long distances at a real slow pace, it's very what? Soothing. It's very calming. You're on an even rhythmical, okay? If I bounce on a ball at a nice, even pace, it's very calming. Okay, so massage, obviously, rhythmic rocking, vibration, anything that increases the oxygen. A lot of programs are using things like yoga and breathing, Pilates, all that where you're kind of breathing and increasing your oxygen is very calming. A lot of the individual that I put up the quote by, yoga has really helped, not because of the positions, but because of the breathing. And when he's real, I told you he's got a real hard time with anxiety, he does a nice breathing strategy to calm. And it's beautiful because it's self-regulated. It's no one saying, you do it, and then, no, it's self-regulating. And he's really learned a lot of the breathing strategies. So predictability, structure, and again, we know a lot of the individuals we serve crave the predictability and structure. It's calming in a really over-stimulating, over-anxious world. Alerting, very different. We know what alerting is. Brisk rub, bouncing, jiggling, tickling, quick rocking, quick changes in direction, wrestling, rough play. And then unpredictability, being off balance, any novelty. You bring out a new toy that the child's never seen, you're going to get an alerting response, whether they're on the spectrum or they're typically developing, because it's novel. You look at what type of kid you're dealing with. And do you have a kid that needs alerting? Or do you have a kid that needs calming? Or a little bit of both, depending upon the time of day and the activity. Okay. It's not like, it would be really schizophrenic to just calm and alert all day at the same time. It's more about, if here's my optimal level, and I take up the pulse of the kids, do we need a nice movement break to go move around? Because we're really, you're seeing, I've sat too long, so let's alert. And then now we have a transition time. How do we transition into that transition time? It varies throughout the day. Just like with you, you're going to have different needs to calm yourself at night. You want to calm yourself. Don't do anything alerting. You know, kids that do wrestling and everything like that right before bed, and you wonder why they can't get to sleep. Okay. But is there a routine at bedtime where I can calm that system down? Depending upon the child. So it really is differentiated instruction. It really is differentiated. It's not, let me calm and alert. It's kind of, what do you need? What do you need in this situation? Meryl Samuels Turner is an OT that I've met this past year. And she's got a great saying, which I think from a strategy perspective and a practical strategy, when in doubt, probe it out. Like, if you don't know what to do, proprioception is probably a good place to start. Okay? And when in doubt, probe it out is, we know that there are powerful properties that help calm and help the person feel where they are in space, and that's, so I credit her with this saying. But I'm going to give you an example of how to, this is, again, using proprioceptive input, and again, he has an OT that's worked with him real, and you know, this is an individual that has had, he's 19 now, every intervention known to the field of autism. Okay. And can remember it all, too. And can tell you about it. What worked and what didn't work. Okay. And he's got a lot of things that have worked that go beyond OT. I'm focusing on the OT. But he talks about, helps move my body better. And you don't have this slide. But OT has made my body calm. OT helps me use my body how I want instead of it controlling. And he really, did I take somebody's? Oh gosh, I'm sorry. touch is now heightened. And he actually is someone that talks about brushing. And again, don't go out and say, brushing now works because I saw it on this slide. This is one kid that is talking about his one experience. But for him, it worked. From brushing, I'm now feeling my body for how to each time move, and it feels good knowing where it is now instead of moving it to feel it. But now I know I can move it because it's now usable. It's getting easier to move and think together. And he talks dramatically about how he can't move and think at the same time. You know, and if you look at it, it feels good knowing where it is now instead of moving it to feel it. Again, something replaced that need. And now he can feel his body and use it more. He still has a lot of motor issues. it's getting easier to move and think together. He talked about doing some work where they wanted him to put like the yellow block on the blue block. And again, he's tested at an IQ of 50, right? And the person would say, put the yellow block on top of the blue block. And he said he knew exactly what they wanted, but he couldn't think and move at the same time. So what happens? Fail that trial. Okay. It totally reinforced in his mind, and he talks a lot about this, so I think that's why he was so mad. It totally reinforced in his mind how incompetent other people thought he was and how incapable. And he's got so many significant motor issues that he talks about. Okay, so proprioceptive, I'm just giving you an example. They affect arousal level. You swaddle that baby calms down. They increase body awareness. You pound, you feel your body more. Modulate vestibular and tactile input. We're going to get into vestibular in a minute, but they really, if you have a kid that really is up, okay, and has done a lot of swinging and spinning and running around, they actually might use this proprioceptive input to help them modulate all that input that they're not processing very adequately. And increase feedback to a child when he receives a motor response. Okay, let's move on. What's the time?
3:35.
I have to keep you to 6. Okay. Okay. So you have to ask yourself when you're looking at these kids from a practical perspective, what are they looking for? If you got a kid that's crashing, bumping, and leaning, yeah. To me, I think that if you do a new strategy, if you are a good data collector, you should see some things you should take a baseline. Definitely take a baseline. Implement your strategy, and then look at it for like 2 or 3 weeks and see if it changes. I don't buy into the fact, well, let's wait a year and see what happens. Because there's so many other intervening factors there. But 2 or 3 weeks, I would say, is it working? And if it's working, then your data will be different. If it's not working, then your data it will show that as well. So, you know. Okay, if a child's biting, holding, pinching. Okay, crashing, bumping, leaning. Those kids are really looking for this combination of deep pressure and proprioception. If the child's biting, holding, and pinching, they're really looking for more of that muscle and tendon, joint and tendon input, that kind of what I gave you when you pounded your leg. Running, crashing, jumping, you know, these kind of overlap. But bottom line is they're looking for proprioceptive input and probably a little bit of vestibular. You have a lot of kids that are looking for vestibular, and vestibular is movement. I'm sorry if I... Vestibular is movement input.
Can you give some more examples of what to do with pinching and biting?
Okay, can you give some more examples of what to do with pinching and biting? I think that could be a 45-minute presentation, couldn't it? Pinching and biting is a deal breaker. Okay, it's not like, oh, he's getting a little input here. He's squeezing, so that's okay. Pinching, biting especially. Biting is a deal breaker. There's no, oh, well, he needs proprioceptive input, so we let him bite other children. Right? Deal breaker, completely. Will not be allowed in school if he bites. Gotta stop biting. Okay? So I think biting, you need to do a comprehensive approach to decreasing biting. Whether it's the behavioral strategies, some of the replacements with the chew toys or the real... There's a lot of like rubber tubing that kids will use sometimes. Really tough textured candy, bagels, apples. Load that mouth up. And it's hard because of the diet restrictions that kids place on themselves. Leather, that fruit leather. Or really sour candy. Or really, you know, try a couple different things that give that mouth input. But biting is a deal breaker that needs a comprehensive approach with people coming at it from a variety of ways.
Does teeth grinding come under the category with the biting, holding, and pinching?
It could. People grind their teeth for a lot of reasons, though. And a lot of people that grind their teeth, depends if they're grinding their teeth during the day or at night. Okay. But, yeah, that could be that looking for input. You can try it. Teeth grinding is a tough one. Teeth grinding and toe walking, two tough ones, whether you're coming at it from a behavioral perspective, a sensory perspective, to really... Because a lot of people that grind their teeth as kids grind their teeth as adults. Yeah.
What about stocking? My son's blinded, and made him little ones attend to school in case he needs it, but he promised I'll put him away at school, which was very good.
That's excellent. He's regulating that himself.
He calls him a sucker.
He did a shirt?
Yeah. He was wearing all his clothes.
Uh-huh. So then you have to make a decision. What's more appropriate? You know, there's a need there, but he's putting him away at school, so that tells you something. He's giving you some indication that he knows when it's appropriate, when it's not appropriate. You know, so did he suck on his shirt at school then? Yeah. So you've got to look at kind of what would work there. And, you know, teachers, you guys can shoot me, but oral motor things and things that you suck on in class, they actually really help some kids. So to say no candy, or, and it may not be candy because, you know, we don't want candy with everybody, but if I have a kid that's sucking on something that is attending and focusing, yes, not every kid is sucking on something, but remember the Pennsylvania, one district in Pennsylvania that lets their kids chew gum for testing. If you're going to do that, then why not we be a little bit more flexible from a universal perspective?
Lots of kids out there chewing on pens instead.
Chewing on pens. How many of you chew on pens? You raised your hand and put it down real quick like it was a shame thing. I do. Again, why do you do it? Why do you do it? Extrapolate that out to individuals that we serve. Okay. This is just some examples, a way to prope with a busy day. Rhymes with cope. These are pretty self-explanatory. Weighted blanket, sleeping bags, etc. I have a mom that lets her wake up, jump on the bed, then he comes down, has this heavy breakfast, puts his backpack on his lap on the bus versus that backpack on the back. Help teacher pull down all the chairs, collect all library books with Buddy and take to the library. This person, and this is an example of one, a pressure vest for circle time. Pressure vests are unlike weighted vests in that they're not weighted. They have like a consistent pressure. They're kind of the huggy vest. See your OT if you want to know what that is. Sit disc cushion for seat work, power break. And the teacher implements a system where the child self-regulates when they need a power break. And they're given power breaks throughout the day. Waiting snacks. This is interesting. This one teacher hands out her kids when they're waiting in line. That's when they get their snack, and they eat their snack while they're waiting. How much behavior do you think she has in line? Very smart teacher. Thankfully for school systems and the archaic nature of our doors in school systems, you have a kid hold one of those doors. That's intense proprioceptive input. Okay. So find those heavy doors and make that kid that door holder. But you see how it's kind of weaving it throughout the day? The point is, it's just, you know, and then unstructured time upon arrival home, or when can I just run around? Video games are not heavy proprioception, but some are getting closer. The Wii Fit, you know? And I would, you know, I'm not saying go out and buy a Wii, but in rehab, in my field, in nursing homes, the Wii's being used, in schools, because it's you already hooked me. I've already bought the farm. It's a video game, right? I'm in. So you don't have to worry about engagement, because I'm here, it's a video game, I got something in my hand, fantastic. But then how can I then look at those as opportunities for getting some of this type of sensory input? Okay. So, yeah, Wii Fit, does anyone own the Wii Fit? And so you got visual of the BMI change. I don't know if you heard her. And her son, who is on the spectrum, came home. He's like, I lost 2 pounds. You know, because again, there's such a strong visual component to it, right? Yet I'm moving and doing something. This may change the evolution of the thumb, as will texting. I suck at texting, but my kids are like, Mom, I can do it faster. Okay. I don't know what the thumb function is going to be in 20 years. It'll be very different than it is now with what they can do with their thumbs. But you already have a buy-in. And if you can tie that in, you know, with something where they're moving. And it's visually very reinforcing. Visually, very reinforcing.
We do give them those movement breaks, and that's when I see a lot of foot flapping and spinning. Would you consider it acceptable at that time then?
I would say a couple things. I would say, what is your movement break? Is it a random movement break? Or is it a structured movement break? You can do structured movement break. You can do a Pilates lesson, and they're going to get movement. And again, it's looking at, is it just a move, do whatever you want, which you could do, or is it something more structured that then can translate into more functional behavior? Okay. But what it does, it recognizes the need for movement. Now, how you then incorporate that into your classroom, you know, really is up to each individual classroom teacher, but it recognizes the need for it. Okay. Movement, let's talk a little bit about movement, which is vestibular. All body, if in all body positions and in all planes of three-dimensional space, what that means is, I'll give you the maximum. This gives me head movement back and forth, right? Okay, this gives me head movement back and forth. This gives me head movement in different body planes, round and round. Okay. The maximal is going to be round and round with my head upside down. I'm not going to model that for you, but you get the visual. Okay. So the maximum, the biggest bang for my buck, if I'm looking for this, probably is round and round with my head upside down. Does anyone know any individuals that try to look for that kind of movement? And when you put your head upside down, it changes it, right? And even thinking back to yourself, when you were swinging just back and forth, if you leaned your head back, it felt different, right? Okay. So we got to think, look at existing playground spaces. Now, unfortunately, playground spaces are drying up. Okay. And equipment is drying up. And in urban areas, it's a huge problem. Okay. Or if you have a swing, for example, if you have a swing and it's a rotary swing, but you have a rule that you can't go around on the rotary swing, there's like those tire swings that come down on playgrounds, and I've been and consulted with schools where the kids are not allowed to go round and round. And they're only allowed to go back and forth on the tire swing that is meant to go round and round. So what do the kids end up doing? They sneak it in and they get in trouble for going round and round. Okay. You have it there, how are you going to use it? So again, what are some movement opportunities that you can get in the existing playground spaces? That was the example of the absurdity. Can we switch recess and lunch? This is interesting, and actually a couple programs that I've consulted with have done this. And it's blasphemous, I know, sometimes. Okay, does anyone have recess and lunch switched? They switched.
So they always had recess and lunch at different times.
Okay. There was an interesting study that a school did. I think it was in... They were a lot better behaved if they had recess first and then lunch. Again, if we think universally, who gets hurt by that? Anybody? I don't know, maybe the kid that's really wanting that cafeteria pizza at 11 o'clock. Because that's when lunch is, sometimes 10:30. Okay. So if no one gets hurt by it and it might benefit all, that's an example of that universal design. And you just validated a research study that I was going to talk about where it said kids were better behaved. And they collected data on this for the one school district. They actually found that when they switched recess and lunch in this one school district, the rate of diagnosis of ADHD went down. Fancy that. You know, kids worked. They couldn't wait to go play. They went out and played. They came back after playing. They sat and were hungry and ate lunch. Then they went back to class. Again. Vary the movement. And I have one teacher that does this rotation of the head as they pass the answer ball. She's really good. She's really tried to integrate a lot of these things into her classroom. And she does this answer ball thing where they've got to basically do head rotation. She builds in head rotation of answering about other people's interests and things like that. That's the school that I'm working with. We need movement breaks. We already talked about this. Switching it around, behave, then you can move versus move, then you will behave. That's a different shift there, okay? But expect the behavior. It's not just move and then you can move some more. And then you can move again because we really don't know what to do with you. Okay. Really think about what your expectations are. I put some of these things up. We're not going to go too much into this. This is really, the OTs in the room will be familiar with this, but I don't want to get, time-wise, we're
10 up.
Okay, and I want to cover this idea of the motor issue first. So just know that gravitational security, if your therapist talks about that with you, it really is different. It really, these are kids that really have a difficult time and have a very strong emotional response to movement. But it does fall under this rubric of the sensory modulation disorder. It's rare. You don't see it as much. Let me just talk about aversion and tolerance to movement. This, I think I feel pretty confident in saying, is not a sensory modulation disorder. If you get carsick, it's an autonomic nervous system disorder. You get nauseous, you throw up, you got to get out of the car, you get back in the car. Me spinning you in a swing and doing, it's not going to necessarily impact that. So there's this aversion or intolerance to movement where we really just got to be sympathetic to the central nervous system and sympathetic to the sympathetic nervous system. Okay. If you have kids that are car sick, you got to take breaks, and you learn that very quickly. You know, or they got to be in the front seat. It's not necessarily going to be a strategy that, from a sensory modulation perspective, that you're going to address. Okay. We don't have time for this, but I want you to think about this. I'll give you some homework. If you have a child that needs a combination of this proprioceptive and vestibular input, and it's movement, and then that awareness of your body and space, your teams, if that's what they need, your team should be able to come up with, okay, from a sensory diet perspective, and I gave you that whole how to prope with a busy day, that's a sensory diet. Direct intervention, does that child need some direct intervention that will help with those issues, usually delivered by OTs. Environmental modifications. Ball chairs are an example of environmental modifications, or sit discs, okay? Or changing the fluorescent light. Well, that's not vestibular proprioceptive base, but ball chairs, sit discs, etc. Instructional accommodations. Instructional accommodations are, we get a movement break during testing. State testing is really interesting, and the fact that funding's tied with test scores, we've really increased, surprisingly, some of these things that we do in testing situations now. Pretzels are allowed, gum's allowed, movement breaks allowed. Why don't we extend that thinking to daily instruction? A little bit. Okay. And then behavioral strategies. And I think behavioral strategies are tied into, if you have a child that you gave a movement break to, and they come back and are very regulated and focused, reward that and tell them, it looks like that really helped. I really like how you attended after you took those library books. You know, make it into a reinforcement there versus if you sit here for 10 more minutes, then you get the movement break. Because then that's telling that kid, yeah, that movement break helped me. I asked for it. I came back and I started working. How about that? Okay, and really look at that from a behavioral perspective. Okay, back to this chart. I'm just going to talk about the motor. The two types that, and again, we're not going to get into this. If you want more information, I can send it to you. But there are two types in this taxonomy that I presented earlier. The dyspraxia, which has that tactile and proprioceptive base, that your arm's asleep at night. If you can't feel it, how are you going to use it? You're not going to be able to use it for too much goal-directed movement, are you? Think about the next time that happens at night when you wake up, try to pick something up. If you can't feel it, you can't use it that well. And then postural disorders, these are kids that have a lot of difficulty with balance, that have a more vestibular base or a movement base. They have difficulty, they may not cross the midline, or they have difficulty looking real coordinated and having good balance. And again, Nick is another friend that I interviewed. I know what you want me to do, I just can't make my body do it. And that's really, I think, for so many of the individuals, and a lot of the individuals that are nonverbal have told us this, I know what you want me to do, I just can't make my body do it. And I think from moving my body is impaired and I can't move and think at the same time. We already talked about this. And Tom is very interesting in that he types with one hand. You can imagine how slow it is. And he's the one that did the sounds are costing me. But think about it from that perspective. For us, typing is a perceptual skill that frees up our cognition. And to demonstrate that, how many of you type papers, write papers as you type them? When you're writing notes, or you sit at the computer, what? And you start typing, and you look at the screen, and you're not paying attention down here, are you? Now, some of you are. It's okay. You know, the hunt and peckers. But if I don't have to pay attention down here, it frees me up to compose my paper, correct? Okay. If I have to pay attention down here, it's going to be a little bit harder, isn't it? It's going to be slower. It's going to take me a lot longer. The individual I talked about has to pay attention so diligently down here because he frequently misses up or over. Not frequently, but he does, and he wants to be exact. Like if he misses a letter up, he goes and erases it and gets the next letter. Yet, that's what he's coming up with in what he types. So think about that from that perspective of how much he's trying to get that point across. Okay. Yeah.
It was about the playgrounds. At school, you had this huge playground, but you weren't allowed to climb the trees. That was one of the only things. And it wasn't fenced in. You had this big court. You know, the hoops were torn. But it was really, really big. And you could run around. Now, at home down, you have this little fenced-in area with a bunch of concrete pavement next to it.
We have someone that's unhappy with his playground status. I would be unhappy, too. So, I think you're right.
I know you've made several references to this person who's nonverbal. What do you do, if you say he types, you have him type with one finger?
I don't have him type, he types with one finger.
Okay, well, how do you do it? Because I had one or two kids in my class that started to try to use, learn to use Word. But what do they do to get them to, learn to type, because it seems like it'd be a pretty efficient way of communicating your thoughts.
It is efficient, and for some individuals that don't have the same motor issues, it's very efficient. He has significant motor issues that don't make it quite as efficient, but he's willing to stick with it and do it to get his what he wants to say out. He has become more efficient, but it's still pretty labor intensive. You know, but it is, you're right. I think typing could be a very efficient way.
So if you're having them type, or you want them to type, it's just a matter of having them first find the letters on the keyboard and then put the words together.
There's a lot of typing programs and things like that that I can refer you to that are very visually engaging and reinforcing for a lot of the individuals. But it's not, if you have a lot of the motor issues too, it's going to be tough as well. And here's our person that knows a lot.
No, that's why I need this session. I just had a question with, like, in my position, I get called about kids who have blown out of school because of headbanging, self-injurious, a lot of behaviors that they're no longer in their school program and they're sitting at home. Mm. And then we have a team, then there's an OT, and there's a behavior specialist. And I guess with just listening to what you're saying, when they need a combination of like a behavior intervention as well as, is it a sensory, like, trying to understand what they're doing. Is it sensory? Is it behavior because they're escaping from you? Would it be best for the OT and the behavior specialist to be working together with that kid at the same time? Because they always seem to like, OT's going to come in Monday at 3, behavior specialist is coming in.
To be honest,
I
absolutely think that would be important. I think that OTs and speech therapists, and I think they should always co-treat with these kids. You know,
because it's so easy when you're saying that. I know when I think about all the meetings I go to, everyone's there at different times.
And you know, that's kind of pie in the sky, and you know, but I'll tell you, from a practical perspective, in this NEST program that I'm consulting with, we're doing this in New York City, which is an incredible mess of a situation, huge, complicated district. And in a public school, we found a way to have the OT, the speech therapist, the special ed teacher, and the regular ed teacher meet regularly and also do a social development instruction together anywhere from 2 to 4 times a week. You know, and we've got to start doing that, I think. Now, how do you do that? You can say, that'll never work. Or you can say, maybe this will really, if the behavioral specialist and the OT work together, you probably will never have that question again. Is it sensory or is it behavior? They'll just look and problem solve. Versus the behavior specialist coming on Monday, the OT gets Wednesday. You know, and that's a service delivery. And that's one of the issues on one of the last slides I said. It's service delivery. And how are we going to deliver services? Okay, dyspraxia. I gave you some examples. What we want to do, plan, sequence the action, and execute the action, and our body needs to respond to our commands. Classic motor planning faux pas. You have a child, wants to swing. I have the idea. They go up to the swing, and what do? They kind of step forward this way, and they find themselves stuck. Okay. Good idea, bad plan, poor execution. Okay, that's motor planning in its most simplest terms. Dyspraxic developmental coordination disorder is a diagnosis that's used more in Canada and some of the UK and Australia as compared to this country. But developmental coordination disorder is a diagnosis that is given to kids that have motor issues, can also co-occur. Again, I talked about an idea, a plan, an execute. And a lot of the children that we see break down with the idea or the faulty plan. You got great equipment, you got great stuff, and you have the kid that comes in and just runs back and forth. That's the best idea they can put together. Okay. They know they want to do something, they just don't know what to do. Or they'll go and they'll hit the ball like this, but they kind of don't know what to do with the ball. And some people with autism cannot feel their body. They describe this as frightening, frustrating, exhausting, and humiliating. Some cannot initiate an action without a physical or external cue. We had one guy that said, which struck me, because again, I can't understand this. The only way I can get my head around it is if I think about the arm asleep. I'll get your question in a minute. He told us that he didn't know he was sitting unless someone touched him. So when he got the command to stand up, he didn't respond because he didn't know he was sitting. That's a tough one to wrap my head around, but I'm just the messenger here. Okay. What's your question in the back? Do you see dyspraxia or motor coordination issues that have the midline brain defects? Are you talking about like agenesis of the corpus callosum? Yeah, you would. I mean, because we both sides of the body talk to each other. So yeah, I think I understand what you're talking about. But okay. Dyspraxia. There's a colleague that just got funding to look at apraxia in the mouth with autism. But if you have dyspraxia in the body, if it's found in the whole body, it interferes with your ability to gesture, imitate, which we know a lot of the individuals on the spectrum have difficulty with. And I will. There's a research study that I think shows this, that it's definitely related to dyspraxia. But in spite of dyspraxia, receptive language and cognitive ability can be intact. If you get nothing out of this, you know, you think about my one friend who represents many. Sorry, I have someone in my eye. He has severe dyspraxia that interferes with his ability to talk, gesture, but has found systems of communication where cognitively and receptively he's intact. One of my grad students, when he came up to present at NYU, asked him, well, how did it feel, you know, not being fully aware receptively, but not being able to express? And if any of you have older relatives that have had a stroke, that have had aphasia, and all of a sudden lose the ability to talk, how do they feel? They're incredibly frustrated. Incredibly frustrated that receptively, but they can't express. I think it's very similar for a lot of these individuals. Very similar for a lot of these individuals. And that frustration, you know, my bias is behavior is communication. What is it trying to communicate? But if I'm receptively intact and can't express, and that's got to be really, really tough. Really, really tough. There's some more references. This is an article that I would definitely recommend reading if you're interested in this topic. It was put out by people at Kennedy Krieger, developmental medicine, child neurology, but they looked at dyspraxia and autism, and the lack of physical grace and agility is at a request of a colleague of mine who's on the spectrum. I used to have clumsy on the slide, and he felt very offended about that. So dyspraxia is not accounted for by the lack of physical grace and agility or basic motor skills. Basically, what they're saying is that praxis performance in this sample that was done by non-OTs primarily is that it was a strong predictor of the communication and social and behavioral deficits you saw. They used a test called the Florida Apraxia Battery, but it really was strongly correlated. Individuals that had more praxis issues and had much poorer motor planning had poor social, behavioral, and communicative skills, independent of their motor skill development, independent of that motor skill milestone. This is a test that we use in OT. It's a sensory integration and practice test. It's a bear of a test to give. It's a horrible test to give as far as from a being able to sit and attend. And what I just put up here, which I found very interesting, and it's an N of 7, so you can't really pay attention to it, but it's a very tough test to take. And individuals that were on the spectrum scored, in this small sample, scored all within normal range on tests except for the ones that measured praxis. And to score on the normal range on some of these is tough, except for the ones that measure praxis. And you don't have to know what these are, but it's they're praxis tests. Like oral praxis, for example, you say, pukata, pukata. Well, what does pukata mean? It means I got to do lips, pa, ka, back of the throat, ta, tongue to the mouth, the roof of the mouth, okay? And coordinate all that. Okay. So what do you do with praxis? Again, just in general, I can't give you the cookbook of ideas. I just want you to think differently. But require kids to have an idea and expand on those ideas. Were you the therapist teacher plays dumb? Well, where are we going to go next? And what are you going to, you know, have them expand upon the ideas, especially when they're doing movement activities. Teach the movement activities. Teach playground games. These are kind of from the bottom up, top down. Teach your kids SPUD. What's SPUD? If you don't know, go Google it. Go YouTube it. You'll see kids playing SPUD. Okay. But if I spend some time teaching, because motor learning and kind of motor planning is hard, if I teach playground games, you've given me a good skill. And then the social development time that we do in this ASD NEST program, one of the things that the therapists and the teachers do is they teach playground games. And I'll tell you a success story. One of the kids loves SPUD. Went in gym class, went to the gym teacher and said, hey, can we play SPUD? Gym teacher didn't know what it was. The kid that was on the spectrum taught the entire class how to play SPUD. And then it went out onto the playground. That's inclusion with a capital I. Okay, but you helped me practice the skill, because I'm not going to be able to just necessarily jump into that playground game and get it. Oops. Oh, what did I do? Okay, we've already talked about using heavy work. When in doubt, probe it out. It goes back to that. If you do a lot of things with heavy work and really provide experience that can be found in the natural environment, that weightlifting, the swimming, the anything that provides resistance in the natural environment, strongly support. Okay. This is just shows you a sequence of easy to hard. When we think about motor planning, so if you're working with your kids with motor planning, you might have to really go back to the stationary object, stationary child. And you can see, you know, any motor activity that you're working with the kids on, if you have a stationary object and a stationary child, it's going to be easier than if you have a moving child, moving object. Does that make sense? Okay, so that might be something you want to think about if you're doing motor, anything motor. And again, I'm not up here to give you a list of motor activities to do with your kids, but if you think this way and think, Stationary child, stationary object. Let me start there and work my way up. You can do it with anything. You can do it with anything. Okay, we're not gonna, okay. A lot of postural disorders is another part of that chart. I don't really have the time that I want to spend on this, but here are some of the signs of it, which really, if you're interested in this, I think if you have OTs on your team, they can talk to you about it. But a lot of these kids do crave movement. They have maybe a little bit low tone. They have poor equilibrium and balance problems. Okay. And this is a lot. This falls under that rubric of a lot of direct intervention that would be done by the therapist and then giving you some suggestions. We talked about those two sides of the brain, two sides of the body together in a coordinated manner. Crossing midline. I'm crossing midline when I do this. I'm going from this side to this side. When I do diagonal lines, I cross midline. Okay. That's why when developmentally, kids cross midline and do diagonal lines later than straight lines, right? And as a kid learns to make a triangle, what do? They kind of go straight, and eventually somewhere in space and somewhere in time they'll meet. They're learning that. They're learning that integrating of two sides of the body in that crossing midline, which is a diagonal line if you're talking about handwriting. Okay. Sorry, I'm rushing through this. What do you do if you have problems with kids that are having problems crossing midline again and having problems really using two sides of their body together? Do a lot of things that require them to do two sides of their body together. Have one of your movement breaks be different kinds of jumping jacks. You know, combine it. Have one of your, you know, there's some great, like, exercise. See, it's not going to hurt anybody. You look at obesity, childhood obesity. Doing movement breaks where you're exercising is a wonderful thing. Wonderful thing. It's not going to hurt anybody. So how can you get more of these things throughout your day? Okay. I put symmetrical. I'm not going to do it, but that's a regular jumping jack. Asymmetrical, something like this. You just do it where it's more asymmetrical. But again, that's going back to, I think, someone's point about, well, when they move, they just flap. They run around flap. What if you did like a little exercise program and or Pilates or something like that where you're incorporating a lot of these movements and you're again showing them a way to get the movement input, but then in a way that teaches them something that they may have difficulty with. Crossing the midline. Your OT can definitely give you some ideas. With eyes, that's tracking. Doing figure eights on boards and racetracks on boards, or playing the goalie and going back and forth this way. Those are all good little activities. Okay, we're not going to spend too much time talking about that. Okay. All right. Some assessment issues. There's a lot of assessment. I think two things you need to consider, which we already talked about. What's the impact of inadequate sensory processing and praxis, and what's the contribution, which would be the extent. So you're looking at impact and extent. If it's not impacting their functional abilities, okay, that's a good thing. And it might just be that normal variation we talked about. But how much is it contributing to what you're seeing? And that's that extent. And that's why, wouldn't it be wonderful if we kind of worked together and talked about all these issues together? Okay, some other issues. Fidelity as an issue. Are we demonstrating fidelity? You know, are we doing things in a way that is meeting the needs of these kids from a sensory processing perspective? Are we tying it to relevant outcomes? And are we tying it to relevant outcomes based on the intervention? I think we, as I'm talking to the OTs here in the room, count better. Learn from our behavioral colleagues. Do an intervention and count better. Okay, versus try this, it might work. Okay. And I think that's from, and natural settings. Can we deliver this in natural settings? I can do a clinic-based intervention an hour, three times a week but can we deliver it in natural settings with different service delivery models and talk about it? You know, the grant that we're writing right now is for the New York City Public Schools, and it's really, the executive director for special education for New York City is on board with this, which is shocking. I don't know if we slipped it under, or it was a good day, whatever. But we're saying, let's look at sensory processing, self-regulation, social engagement, how is it related? Let's study this versus don't talk about it, because I think what happens with the SI and schools, here's what happens. Someone that's been an expert witness for both sides, many sides, etc. You say the word SI, or you say the word sensory processing, and the school has a visceral reaction to that because it means SI in a clinic, very expensive, we can't provide it. So now you have 6 degrees of separation versus saying sensory processing in the function of the school if it impacts their education. And we all talked about that optimal level of arousal. You can make an argument that an optimal level of arousal and sensory responsivity absolutely impacts education. So, but how do we do it? It shouldn't look like it does with the 6 degrees of separation. How do we make it work in schools? Where you got 30 hours of an intervention. We already talked about sensory stimulation and then demonstrating of treatment efficacy. Okay? And I do think that this can be done in schools. I do think it can be done in schools. It's going to look different. This ASD-NEST program, one of the missions is that we need to educate kids. Now, they have they're doing it with high-functioning autism, and then we have an intensive K that has kids, I don't even like to use the word lower functioning, I don't know what that means anymore, but kids that have more challenges. And looking at educating in neighborhood public schools. It's a challenge, but I think if everyone, and there was one power horse 4 years ago that did it, but really, these are the key elements in the schools. And if you want more information on this ASD-NEST program, email me and I'd be more than happy to give it to you. It goes from pre-K, and our oldest is 9th grade now. I consult with the middle school things change. Surprise. Developmentally, they change. Social development instruction, here's an example of how it changes in middle school. This SDI time is when the kids that are on the spectrum come and they learn these skills, and the teachers are there, and they integrate it into the classroom, and we do peer-mediated instruction. The kids in middle school that are on the spectrum, the issue becomes, I don't like these kids that are in my little social group. Why would I socialize with these kids? Okay? And they got a point. You and I socialize with people we like around our preferred interests. Two things, right? You don't go socialize, well, you might just to demonstrate some social desirability, but you don't go socialize around people you don't like with things you don't like to do, do you? So in middle school, we're looking at social clubs around preferred interests, where we're doing typical developing peers, individuals on the spectrum, computer club. And if you're interested in computer club, you're in. And guess what we're finding? If we use preferred interest or circumscribed interest, a lot of things we've labeled preoccupations and obsessions earlier on, if we use those, I get kids that buy into the social group and want to be there, and actually talk to each other. Okay? Again, it's really looking at kind of from a longitudinal perspective, how do these things change? Small classrooms, there are small classrooms. With kindergarten, it's a max of 12. Yeah. But the school district bought into it. Okay. At home, parents know best and what works. I strongly believe that, just like I believe that individuals on the spectrum know what works for them. Okay, parents, you guys know what works. And if you're given a home program and you're doing something and you're going, I don't understand why I'm doing this, go ask. And if you don't get the answer, that's not good. Okay. Or you're doing something and it clearly doesn't work. And you know it doesn't work. Okay. You know best. We're not with your kids 24 hours a day. You are with them 24 hours a day. Okay. And not a need to look like therapy. I think that the pressure on parents is enormous right now to mimic all these interventions that professionals are doing, and you begin to come up feeling, I'm not doing a good enough job. That's a shame. That's a shame we put you in that position. Okay. Because you know best, you know what works, you know what doesn't work, you need guidance, let's empower you. I think that by setting up a situation where you're never doing anything right, It's not helping your kid. It's not helping your kid, so I think we need to be mindful about that. Taking time out, all of you, and great sensory and learning-based activities are typically what happens. And I say this because I have a good friend of mine who has, child has 40 hours, actually 60 hours of intensive services. They just had a phenomenal week at the beach with no help. He said he was so happy. He's talking so much. So when you get rid of us, great things can happen. Okay? There are very natural, wonderful experiences without the guilt of thinking, I'm not doing anything. You're not doing anything, might be doing everything. Okay? What are you going to do with that input? Again, if you're doing a lot of this input, what are you going to do with it? What do you want them to be able to do? I think you get some help from the professionals on your team about what would you expect. And then the beauty and curse of YouTube and other generated content. It's out there on YouTube. Everyone that has a child that's on the spectrum has posted an intervention technique related to sensory. So I would I don't want to encourage you to... If you're unsure of what something is, go Google it or YouTube it, and you'll see a video. I can't vouch for the content of that video, but if you hear about something, you go, I have no idea what that is, trust me, it's on YouTube. Trust me. And then a final word, this is from Tom, who I talked about earlier, and he typed this, but I think for him, the sensory and the motor ramifications are so profound, yet he's found a way to communicate about them, yet that doesn't mean they don't impact him. And his last quote, a smart mind trapped and slowly pushing through the dismal body to show my brilliant mind. And he talked about life as a spy to my grad students. He said, yeah, he goes, I was a spy for 14 years. So he's got a good sense of humor. Okay, and then here's my contact information. If you want the references, if you want, just email me is good. I'll be more than happy to answer questions.
Okay. All right, well, thank you very much.
Yay.